lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight.
You're listening to episode 691 of Unwelcome Guests. Big drugs, big money, and big guns. I'm Robin Upton, and we've looked before on the show at the so-called Iron Triangle, Congress, special interest groups, and the bureaucracy. Well, corrupt though it is, that is a publicly acknowledged phenomenon. It's even got a Wikipedia page. We're going to start looking this time at a more secretive sort of triangle, large-scale drug trafficking operations. As we've established before on the show, tend to be organized by the deep state because they're the only group which can guarantee protection from the law enforcement agencies, and their intelligence gathering activities is generally sufficient to shut down any large-scale competition. So large-scale narco trafficking, which of course reaps huge profits laundered through banks, and what's done with these profits is up to the same people who organized it, often includes large-scale purchasing of weapons, for example, to silence any opposition to the drug running. Now, this could have become an established phenomenon after the Iran-Contra affair, except for the deep state's control of the corporate media. Even the name Iran-Contra doesn't mention drugs or weapons, as if it was something of a one-off. In fact, this is a repeated phenomenon, and this week we're focusing on heroin. Our first speaker, Professor Alfred McCoy, author of The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, states that Afghanistan is the center of the world's heroin production. Whilst it's very hard to assign responsibility and to know exactly what's going on in a country that's been in the middle of a brutal war for over a decade, circumstances seem to have conspired to leave local people with little realistic alternative except for large-scale opium cultivation. And this notwithstanding the claim of the invading countries to try to eradicate opium production. As he notes, policies are repeatedly followed which have a track record of failing to do that. Now, I'll let you decide to what extent these repeated policies are a failure, or to what extent they might represent a success in the true goals of running a highly profitable illicit drug trade. Thanks to Mike McCormack of Talking Stick TV for this video, which I got from YouTube. This is a talk from 2010 entitled Low Intensity Conflict in the Drug Wars.
My topic is Afghanistan. Today I want to talk to you about how and why the United States has, in my view, become trapped in an endless cycle of drugs and death in Afghanistan, a Sisyphean cycle from which there is no easy end nor obvious exit. Let me begin this talk with an anecdote plucked from the front pages of your daily newspaper. After a year of cautious debate and costly deployments, President Obama finally launched his new Afghan war strategy at 2:40 a.m. on February 13th of this year in a remote Afghan market town called Marja. As a wave of U.S. helicopters descended into Marja's outskirts, spitting up clouds of dust, hundreds of U.S. Marines dashed through fields sprouting opium poppies towards the town's mud wall compounds. After a week of fighting finally expelled the Taliban guerrillas, U.S. Afghan Commander General Stanley A. McChrystal choppered into town with Afghanistan's vice president and the provincial governor of Helmand in tow. Their mission? A media rollout for the general's new-look counterinsurgency strategy based on bringing government to the people in remote villages just like Marja. But at a carefully staged meet-and-greet with some 200 villagers, the vice president and provincial governor met some unexpected, unscripted local anger. If they come with tractors, one Afghani widow announced to a chorus of supportive shouts, they will have to roll over me and kill me before they can kill my puppy. For these farmers and thousands more just like them, government control had brought the very real threat of opium eradication. Throughout all this shooting and shouting, American commanders seemed somehow oblivious to the fact that Marja was arguably the world's heroin capital. With hundreds of heroin laboratories hidden inside these mud brick houses and the surrounding fields of Helmand province producing a remarkable 40% of the world's illicit opium supply. As one U.S. Embassy official, just back from inspecting the opium districts of Helmand, said to me in a recent phone call, quote, you can't win this war without taking on drug production in Helmand province. Just as these Marja farmers spoiled General McChrystal's media event, so their drug harvest has subverted every regime that has tried to rule Afghanistan for the past 30 years. During the Cold War decade of the 1980s, the CIA provided the guns and opiums to finance a guerrilla war that drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan and destroyed their Marxist client regime. In the 1990s, the Taliban's government lost international legitimacy by taxing opium and then fell from power only months after banning the crop. Since the U.S. military intervened in Afghanistan in 2001, a rising opium harvest has corrupted the legal government in Kabul and empowered a resurgence of Taliban guerrillas in the countryside. Through their endless violence, these three wars over the past 30 years have fueled a relentless rise in Afghanistan's opium harvest from about 250 tons in 1979 to 8,200 tons in 2007. That latter figure representing 50% of the country's entire economy and over 90% of the world's illicit opium supply. By 2001, the ecological devastation and social dislocation from 20 years of war made opium the solution to a social crisis so severe, so complex, that it has defied Washington's comprehension. Whipsawed between ignoring the opium crop and demanding its total eradication, the Bush administration dithered for 7 years while heroin boomed, creating a drug economy that corrupted and crippled the government of its ally, President Karzai. Today, opium feeds Afghanistan's farmers, employs approximately a quarter of the country's labor force, and funds the Taliban's insurgency that has, since 2006, revived and spread across the countryside. So pervasive and problematic is opium in Afghanistan today that we must ask the hard question that Washington has avoided for the past 9 years. How can anyone pacify a narco state? The answer to this complex question lies in a history, first, of drug prohibition during the past century, and second, of CIA-covered operations during the Cold War. Since the Shanghai Opium Conference of 1909, global drug prohibition has elaborated into a national come international legal structure, which is the basic precondition for the emergence of illicit drugs a century later as a major global commodity with 8% of world trade, $400 billion in global sales, and transnational trafficking syndicates with an estimated 3,500,000 members. More immediately, in each of these three wars fought in Afghanistan over the past 30 years, Washington has tolerated drug trafficking by its Afghan allies as the price of military success, a policy of benign neglect that has helped make Afghanistan the world's number one narco state. First, CIA covert warfare during the 1980s. At the start of the Cold War in the late 1940s, the Iron Curtain came crashing down across the Eurasian landmass. To contain Soviet and communist Chinese expansion, the United States mounted covert operations to probe communism's soft southern underbelly, a highland rim stretching for 5,000 miles across Asia from Turkey to Thailand. For 40 years, the CIA fought a succession of secret wars along this mountain rim, Burma in the 1950s, Laos in the 1960s, and Afghanistan in the 1980s. In one of history's ironic accidents, the Iron Curtain had also fallen along Asia's historic opium zone, drawing the CIA into ambiguous alliances with the region's highland warlords, from Laos to Burma and Afghanistan. Washington's first Afghan war began in 1979 when the Soviet Union invaded the country to save its client regime in Kabul. Seeing an opportunity to wound its Cold War enemy, Washington worked with Pakistan in a 10-year CIA campaign to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan. But this was a covert operation, arguably unlike any other during the 40 years of the Cold War. First, the fusion of CIA covert and Soviet conventional warfare inflicted almost indescribable destruction on Afghanistan's fragile highland ecology, damaging its agriculture almost beyond repair and fostering a growing dependence on the international drug traffic. Second, the CIA, instead of conducting this covert warfare on its own, as it had in Laos, for example, outsourced much of the operation to Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence, or ISI, which soon became a powerful and problematic ally. When the ISI proposed its Afghan client, the Islamic fundamentalist Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, as the overall leader of the Allied anti-Soviet resistance, Washington, with few alternatives and less intelligence, agreed. As the CIA operation was winding down 10 years later in May 1990, the Washington Post published a page one article charging that the CIA's ally, Hekmatyar, a recipient of over half the $3 billion we had funneled into Afghanistan, was operating a chain of heroin laboratories in Pakistan under the protection of Pakistan's ISI. Now, although this region had zero heroin production in the mid-1970s, by 1981, in the second year of this covert war, the Afghan-Pakistan borderlands had become the world's largest heroin producer. As Afghani guerrillas captured prime agricultural areas inside Afghanistan in the early 1980s, they collected a revolutionary property tax from their peasant supporters, raising opium production tenfold from 250 tons in 1981 to 2,000 tons by 1990. Once the Afghan guerrillas brought the opium across the border, they sold it to the hundreds of Pakistani heroin labs operating under ISI's protection. Across Europe, Afghani and Pakistani heroin captured an even larger share of local markets. In 1981, for example, the U.S. Attorney General announced that Pakistan was the source of 60% of the U.S. heroin supply. Inside Pakistan itself, the number of heroin addicts rose from zero heroin addicts in 1979 to 1,200,000 5 years later. After investing $3 billion in Afghanistan's destruction, Washington just walked away in 1992, leaving Afghanistan with over a million dead, 5 million refugees, 10 to 20 million landmines, a ravaged infrastructure, a ruined economy, and well-armed tribal warlords ready to fight for power. After the U.S. withdrew, Pakistan's ISI continued to back local warlords and drug lords in pursuit of its long-term goal of installing a Pashtun client regime in Kabul. Next, the Civil War of the 1990s. After the U.S. and USSR withdrew from Afghanistan in 1992, ruthless local warlords combined guns and opium in a brutal struggle for power, almost as if the soil had been sown with the mythic dragon's teeth that bring forth an army full-grown, fully armed warriors, swords drawn for combat. When Hekmatyar failed to take the capital after shelling the city and killing 50,000 people, Pakistan's ISI armed a new force, the Taliban, that captured Kabul in September 1996 and then fought the Northern Alliance for the next 5 years in the valleys beyond. During this protracted civil war of the 1990s, rival factions used opium to finance the fighting, doubling the harvest from 2,000 tons in 1990 to a record of 4,600 tons by 1999. Beneath the surface of this sudden change lurked a fragile ecological balance of field crops, orchards, and herding that could not recover unaided from such unprecedented devastation from 20 years of war. Lying at the northern extremity of the monsoon, where the rain clouds arrive squeezed dry from the Arabian Sea, Afghanistan is an arid land whose staple food crops have been sustained historically by a delicate snowmelt irrigation system and constantly threatened by drought. To supplement staples such as wheat, tribesmen move vast flocks of sheep and goats hundreds of miles every year to summer pasture in the central uplands. Most importantly, Afghan farmers also planted perennial tree crops, walnut, pistachio, and mulberry, since they root deep, resist drought, and serve as famine relief in the dry years. During these two decades of covert and civil warfare, modern firepower devastated herds, damaged snowmelt irrigation, and destroyed orchards, crippling this fragile ecology's capacity for recovery. The Taliban, with an unerring instinct for their society's economic jugular, violated the rules of traditional warfare by destroying the orchards on the vast Shamali Plain north of Kabul. As all of these strands of post-war devastation knitted themselves into a Gordian knot of social, economic, and ecological suffering, opium became the sole solution, like Alexander's sword of legend, that could cut through these problems. In an arid ecosystem, opium uses half the water of wheat, is drought-resistant, lightweight, and easy to transport, stores long-term without significant loss, is labor-intensive, accumulates capital for dealers, is the highest profit crop for farmers, and provides half the capital handled in the country's vernacular hawala money transfer and money lending system. In marked contrast to its marginal yields for most crops, Afghanistan's climate was ideal for opium, with its average yield per hectare 3 to 5 times higher than its chief illicit competitor, Burma. After taking power in 1996, the Taliban regime encouraged a nationwide expansion of opium cultivation, doubling production to a record 4,600 tons in 1999, equivalent to 75% of the world's heroin supply. Instead of banning the drug, the Taliban regime collected $100 million in taxes from both opium production and heroin refining. In retrospect, the Taliban's most important innovation was the introduction of large-scale heroin refining around the city of Jalalabad. But in July 2000, Taliban's Mullah Omar, desperate for international recognition, ordered a sudden ban on all opium cultivation and accomplished almost overnight a 90% reduction in the country's opium production, slashing it from 4,000 tons down to 185 metric tons in 2001. But by then, Afghanistan had become an opium monocrop, dependent on poppy production for most of its taxes, export income, and employment. Thus, the Taliban's opium ban was, I think, an act of economic suicide that brought an already weakened society to the brink of collapse. When the U.S. invaded in October 2001, the Taliban regime was already a hollow shell that simply imploded at the burst of the first American bombs. Third and finally, U.S. counterinsurgency warfare since 2001. The outbreak of war with Washington in September 2001 ended the Taliban's opium ban. To defeat the Taliban, the CIA mobilized former warlords long active in the heroin trade to seize towns and cities across eastern Afghanistan. Within weeks, officials reported an outburst of poppy planting in the eastern part of the country. After investing some $3 billion in Afghanistan's destruction during the Cold War, Washington and its allies now proved parsimonious in reconstruction. At the January 2002 Tokyo's donor conference, for example, international representative promised just $4 billion of the estimated $10 billion needed to rebuild the economy over the next 5 years. Consequently, during the first year of U.S. occupation, Afghanistan's opium harvest surged from 185 tons to 3,400 tons. As opium production continued its relentless rise, Washington downplayed the problem, outsourcing narcotics control to Great Britain and police training to Germany. In their counterinsurgency campaign as well, U.S. forces, including the CIA, worked closely with the local warlords, who were also leading drug lords. After 5 years of U.S. occupation, Afghanistan's drug production swelled to unprecedented proportions. In August of 2007, the U.N. reported that the country's opium crop covered 200,000 hectares, an area larger than all the cocoa fields in Latin America, and yielded 8,200 tons of opium, representing 53% of Afghanistan's gross domestic product and 93% of world heroin supply. Afghanistan had become the world's first real narco state. If a cocaine traffic that provided just 3% of Colombia's GDP could bring endless violence and powerful cartels, then we can only imagine the consequences of an Afghanistan dependence on opium for over 50% of its economic activity. Indeed, opium's influence is so pervasive that corruption cripples every government activity, compromising every attempt at opium eradication. Not only have drug taxes funded an expanding Taliban guerrilla force, but their role in protecting opium farmers and the heroin merchants give them control over the nation's core political economy. Since that record crop of 2007, opium production has declined somewhat to 6,900 tons last year, still representing over 90% of the world's opium supply. The UN attributes this 20% reduction to eradication efforts, but a more likely cause was a global glut of heroin that depressed farm gate opium prices by 34%. Even this reduced Afghan opium crop of about 7,000 tons is still well above world demand at 5,000 tons per annum, creating downward market pressures on both price and production. Although preliminary reports on the 2010 crop indicate a steady state, the UN is not optimistic about long-term trends. Opium prices might decline, but the poppy is still the most profitable crop for Afghan farmers. In this ancient land sown with dragon's teeth, we are locked into an endless cycle of drugs and death. Every spring in these rugged mountains, the snows melt, the opium seeds sprout, and a fresh crop of Taliban fighters take to the field to be gunned down by lethal American fire. And the next year, the snows melt again, the poppy comes through the soil, and a new crop of teenage Taliban fighters takes to the field to fight America. Is there any alternative to this endless Sisyphean cycle that we've been engaged in for the past 10 years? Even if the cost of rebuilding Afghanistan's rural economy with orchards, flocks, and food crops is as high as $30 billion or even $90 billion, we have the money right at hand. By conservative estimates, the cost of President Obama's ongoing surge of 30,000 troops is $30 billion a year, every year for the foreseeable future. Although slow and costly, crop substitution, akin to the UN drug control program in Thailand during the 1980s, is the only public policy option without a proven record of disastrous, unanticipated consequences. Short of another precipitous withdrawal akin to 1991, Washington really has no realistic alternative to the costly, long-term reconstruction of Afghanistan's agriculture. The idea that our expanded military might soon hand over pacification to the illiterate, drug-addicted Afghani police and army remains, for the time being, pure fantasy. Quick fixes like paying poppy farmers not to plant, something British and Americans have both tried, can backfire and incentivize expanded production. Rapid drug eradication without alternative employment, like that DynCorp, a U.S. defense contractor, did so disastrously under $150 million contract in 2005, would simply plunge the Afghan country into misery, stoking mass anger and destabilizing the Kabul government. So our choice is clear. We can renew this arid, ancient land by replanting or assisting the people in replanting orchards, replenishing the flocks, and rebuilding the snowmelt irrigation for food crops. Or we can instead water this dragon's teeth soil with more blood in an endless cycle of drugs and death. At this point, I would argue our only realistic choice is rural development, that is, reconstructing the Afghan countryside through countless small-scale projects until food crops become a viable economic alternative to opium. To put it simply, so simply that even Washington might understand, we can only pacify a narco state when it is no longer a narco state. Thank you.
And for more videos in that vein, go to the Talking Stick TV channel on YouTube. Thanks to Mike McCormack for that. Now, thanks to James Corbett of CorbettReport.com for the next interview. He's interviewing FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. She's been threatened by the US government and told that certain matters that she must not speak about. Her story is incomplete, but I find it fascinating and certainly fits with a picture of large-scale organized drug trafficking by the deep state involving actors at the very highest levels.
I guess we should explain that we're picking up from a conversation that I had with Tom Secker a week or two ago on the Corbett Report, talking about Gladio and the history of Operation Gladio, the NATO Stay Behind operation. So people who want more on the details of Gladio itself and its history as a historical entity in Europe might want to check out that conversation. But today we're going to be picking up from that to talk about specifically how Gladio unfolded and morphed into what it currently is in Turkey and how it's operating, well, how it's basically morphed into a different type of operation, but is using a lot of the same strategies and methods to continue well, moving into different areas, such as false flag terrorism in the Islamic terrorism context, and also drug running. It's, again, a huge subject to tackle. So perhaps we should start by talking about the way that the NATO Stay Behind Gladio operation was transported to Turkey, and the way that it originally started there as a ultra-nationalist, or a way to puppeteer the ultra-nationalists in their terrorist movement.
One slight correction, and that is the field of operation for Gladio is pretty much global, with a large concentration, main concentration in the last, I would say, 15, 16 years, Central Asia, Caucasus, and the Balkans. And it started with the Balkans. So the field of operation actually has nothing to do with Turkey itself. There is really nothing, because Turkey is where the powers, that's being NATO, U.S., United Kingdom, where it's they want these countries want to be. That's for Turkey. So the fields of operations are basically Central Asia, the former Soviet bloc, basically, and the operations control centers, of course, the main one, the top layer, being in the United States, with major arteries connecting it to the United Kingdom, to Britain, and you have Belgium, and then you have Turkey. So being in maybe the primary, then the secondary, and then the third layer being in Turkey via Turkish actors there, both military, not nearly as much any longer, but also by very large what they refer to as the Islamic factions, several different Islamic factions.
Well, I stand happily corrected on that point, and you're right to bring that out. Of course, the field of operations is all over that Central Asia, Caucasus region, and we have talked about this a little bit in some of our previous conversations, but today let's hone in on some of the characters and people who have been connected to this. And there are lots of things to talk about. I'm not sure where you want to start, but there are, of course, operations like the Grey Wolves and others that have been in Turkey for decades that have done this type of operation in the past. And characters like Abdullah Chatli, who has been involved in this and who has been all over in a very interesting life that ended in the Sisarlık scandal in 1996 in quite an interesting fashion. I'm not sure where you want to start that story, but perhaps you can paint a picture for the listeners about how this really developed and where it went up until that point in the mid-1990s.
Sure. Turkey always was the most important center country in all this Gladio operations before the fall of the Soviet Union. It's interesting because when I go and read what's available, to public online, which is very, very little on Gladio. That's why I was ecstatic when you had your interview on Gladio a week ago. And what you see is usually these like Italy. It's like Gladio and Italy and how it's unfolded, how it was disbanded, etc., etc. But you don't see much on Turkey, and Turkey was the most important operation center for Gladio. And obviously, it's because of its geographic location. Just take a look at Turkey on the map. And if you're looking for, that period of time before the fall of the Soviet Union, from Black Sea to its eastern, you're looking at all the former Soviet blocs being there. And then again, its position within the, Middle East, and the other side being connected to Europe. So Turkey always had the most position within this Gladio operations until, before the fall of the Soviet Union. And that you don't see. There are very few articles written out there, scattered. There's one good one by Le Monde, which was concentrating mainly on the actors you just mentioned, Abdullah Çatlı and Sisarlık incident. And you have a couple of authors in Switzerland and in England who have written about this. Nothing here in the United States on that. So I give you a little bit of history because you covered a lot of this with your previous guest, but this history is going to concentrate more on the characters that we're going to be talking about and the Turkish side on this Gladio operations until the fall of the Soviet Union. And in Turkey, there were two prime groups that were working within Gladio network and carrying out some of the most important operations in Western Europe, in Northern Europe, and mainly in Eastern Bloc. And that was one, the formal official Turkish military. And that is made of both Turkish military and the Turkish military intelligence, directly connected to NATO, Russell, and within the Gladio operations. But then, beneath the military, Turkish official military, you had the paramilitary force. Who were these people? And that's very, very interesting. These people, you know, again, you look at some of the articles and people talking about it. Yeah, they're saying they are ultra-nationalists. But what kind of jobs did they have? Who were these people who were recruited by Turkish military, trained, and absorbed into NATO's, U.S. NATO's Gladio operations? Well, a lot of these people actually in 1980s, they were in jail, okay? They had positions that were, the best way to describe them would be the godfathers in Turkey. Babas, that's how they refer to them in Turkey, the babas, and which means the godfathers. They were the top people who ran, you know, blackmail, heroin operations, and even back then, it was Turkey has always been the most important artery in moving heroin into Europe, whether it came through the borders through Iran or it came via some Kurdish factions coming through Iraq. So Turkey has always been important. And these babas ran, and military did too, Turkish military did too. But they were also ultra-nationalist, but they were secularist ultra-nationalists. They put Atatürk, the father of Turkey, the father of modern Turkey, and basically in the place of God, you know. And of course, Atatürk advocated secularism, forced secularism. And I have to emphasize this, forced secularism. And these guys, even when I was growing up in Turkey, they were very easy to identify. You know, they usually wore this mustache that really resembled the Hitler mustache. And they had salutes that were like for gray wolves, that was like this. And their babas were in jail. And these guys had informants all over, not only in Turkey, but in elsewhere. So as part of Gladio's plan, Turkish military, Turkish police, Turkish intelligence forces, they took all these notorious, I mean, these are psychopaths, sociopaths, okay? These people are mass murderers. They took them out of these prisons and they said, you know what, now you are going to, with your skills, with what you do, with what you know, you're going to serve the state. And that is Turkey and the great Turkishness. And great Turkishness is also being protected by the West because the communists is out there. They're going to take us over. Then we have these issues with the Kurdish people. And meanwhile, you can also fill up your own pockets. You know, you can still be big, you can still be godfather, but your main role, and this is why we are releasing you, bringing you out, is going to be serving us for all these operations. So these guys were removed. They were sent to various centers, including in Brussels, and they received training both via Turkish military, via U.S. NATO forces. And they were given diplomatic passports, not only Turkish passports, but passports from various countries. And they still moved, you know, worked in the area where you move, you know, heroin, but also weapon smuggling, mass murders, a lot of false flag attacks, not only inside Turkey, but in other countries as well. And again, your guests talked about some of these, the assassination attempts of Pope, etc., etc. And they also filled out their own pockets. So these were the characters. Now, it's very interesting. You say, for a lot of people would say, well, you know, this was before, you know, during communism. And we also did things with Mujahideens and Bin Laden in Afghanistan. And also it deals a lot with Turkish politics. So why should that interest people here in the United States? And because this is as much as they know or they read or they hear. So what happens after the fall of the Soviet Union? Well, the character you just mentioned, Abdullah Çatlı, he's one of the main foot soldiers, one of the main commandos under the military, which is Turkish military, which is under NATO and the United States, one of the most notorious figures. I mean, this guy was responsible in and outside Turkey of tens of thousands of murders, bombs. In some cases, they would just storm a house with medical students in Turkey and they would cut everybody's heads. And, you know, those people were accused of advocating for socialism or communism. This guy, it actually ends up on the list of most wanted for, you know, Interpol's most wanted list. Okay. And for various reasons, murders, international murders, not only murders in Turkey, you're looking at Interpol's most wanted, right? Heroin smuggling, weapons smuggling. So he's on the top 10 most wanted people. And this is at post-Soviet Union. And he ends up in a jail, in a high-security prison in Switzerland. He gets arrested during one of his movement's operations. And when you look at some of the reporting on this guy, including the newspapers, you know, or the articles written on the Grey Wolves, it says, while he was in this high security prison in Switzerland, this is Abdullah Çatlı, he escaped. He actually escaped by a supportive helicopter. So you're in a high security prison in Switzerland, and you mysteriously escape via helicopter. And some more detailed stories from very few reporters who followed up and wrote on this, and that was a NATO-owned helicopter. I mean, this really sounds like a movie plot, something that Hollywood would make. And so, yeah, this is the most wanted Interpol guy. It gets even stranger. Same guy, while still wanted after he escapes, NATO helicopter from high-security Swiss prison, he mysteriously ends up in England, in London, okay? And again, mysteriously, in 1989, the government, UK government, grants him citizenship. Huh. It's not even 1 year since he enters UK. He's still the most wanted on Interpol's list. And then, within a year after that, the same guy, Abdullah Çatlı, flies over, comes to the United States, and this is around 1990-1991, comes to Chicago, and is mysteriously given an American passport, American green card. This is not passport yet. And during all this time, he is among the top 10 most wanted people by Interpol, okay? Now, the first question people should ask, especially those who say, oh, this is about some, you know, during Cold War and communism and it's a Turkish internal politics. Why the most wanted guy by Interpol, notorious murderer, drug runner, ends up in England of all the places and gets a citizenship? Why he comes to the United States and is given another citizenship? So that's the first questions listeners should be asking. And why Chicago is where he settles. And that's where he settles. And when he settles there, he has dozens of entry and exit from Chicago. And after the Susurluk scandal, which I'm going to get into it, it basically comes out, you know, with all the investigations they had in Turkey, that from Chicago, he carried out all these operations in Central Asia, Caucasus, Eastern Europe, Xinjiang province of China. So he kept flying. So he's still most wanted by Interpol. Okay? We don't know how and why he got all the citizenships, why he's most wanted, and why he carried 4 or 5 diplomatic passports. Nobody gets into those questions. And these diplomatic passports are not only given to him by government of Turkey. So he, one of his trips, again, this is very well documented. This is not conspiracy theory. This is not some top secret classified documents any longer, because these stuff all came out during this, after this scandal in Turkey. So he, in 1995, he is the one who goes to Azerbaijan from Chicago via Turkey, goes to Azerbaijan with a team of several people, less than a dozen. He carries out this attempted assassination against Aliyev. This is the Aliyev senior before his son became, you know, the president of Azerbaijan. And it was meant to be an attempted that would not succeed. So because if you look at Azerbaijan's position during that same time, 1994 to 1996, before this assassination attempt, you would see that Aliyev was still siding with Russia. It was still the old royalties, you know, the old loyalties of we were part of, you know, the Soviet Union, and we are still siding with Russia. Now, this is when United States, the West, was trying via its proxy, Turkey. Why Turkey? They speak Turkish. What language do they speak in these countries, including Azerbaijan? Turkish. They are Muslim. What's the religion in Azerbaijan and all these ex-Soviet blocs? Muslims. So this was the ideal proxy to go grab countries like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and Azerbaijan and say, okay, say bye-bye to Russia. We want you to be one of us, right? Well, of course, Russia was doing its part from the other side. So during this period when this assassination attempt occurred, Aliyev Sr., the president in Azerbaijan, still was loyal to Russia. And all these different attempts to move him to the other side had not been successful. So they moved to plans that included assassination attempt, paired up with blackmails. Because again, during this time, the doors, the borders were open in Azerbaijan. A lot of these Turkish babas, godfathers, moved in there. And they opened really lavish, interesting casinos. You can say casinos, Azerbaijan, yeah. And guess what? Several Aliyev's families were given advance offerings in these casinos, and they collected a lot of debts, okay? And this is people very close to Aliyev Sr. And they started getting death threats, saying, well, if you don't pay off these millions and millions of dollars of debt in your casino gambling debt, we're going to take you out. Then comes the assassination attempt. So again, if people were to go and look at the records on this assassination attempt on Aliyev, they would see Abdullah Çatlı's name. They would see that Aliyev came out and said the people responsible for this were NATO, US via Turkey. And the Turkish president calling and saying, no, these were the thugs, the mafia people, you know, they have nothing to do with us. All these denials. Whatever happened is Aliyev very quickly switched position after this assassination attempt, okay? You fast forward, look at Azerbaijan. Since 1996, Azerbaijan been the closest ally of United States and NATO. In fact, they are becoming a NATO member. For the last 8 years, NATO has been there with the base, training them. They've been passing the tests. They went from purchasing something like $25 million weapons from worth of weapons from the United States today to something like $4 billion of U.S. weapons. So success. Gladio was successful. It was who carried out Abdullah Çatlı. After he finished, he just shook his hand and said, okay, mission accomplished. Came back again to Chicago. Now I'm going to open a parenthesis here and say, remember, for the past 11, 12 years, I've been talking about the center of all these operations that has to do with my state secrets privilege and people involved was in Chicago. I have been saying Chicago so many times, so I don't believe anyone is, at least not your listeners or mine, who haven't heard this, me saying Chicago, Chicago. So he went back to Chicago. This was one of his trips. His other trips included going from the other side, through the Pacific, going to China, and then from there going to this area, Xinjiang. This is extremely important. Again, Xinjiang, Muslim population, and they are referred to in Turkey. They don't call them Xinjiang. It's Turkistan, you know, Turkistan. They speak Turkic dialect. Guess what? Up there, a great place. Imagine, they get their independence. We can have our little mini base there. You know how close we are to China? I mean, okay, on one hand, you would say, yeah, there is, you know, Hong Kong. There's Taiwan out there. Well, this is going to be even more important than Taiwan. And then look again, the other important strategic location for Xinjiang, for Turkestan, aka Uyghuristan. You look out there, you see Pakistan, you see Afghanistan. This is a very important region. This has been a very important region prize for the United States, for the West. We've been doing a lot of things there. Every time you hear, at least when I was working there during this period that FBI was investigating these, not operations there, but people here, the criminals in the U.S. who carried out the operations there. Those terrorist attacks, they were orchestrated from a long distance. Okay, you go to Turkey, then from Turkey you go to Brussels, to England, and then you go to the United States. So all the orchestration is not some minorities or some Muslims get together, suddenly they go and it doesn't happen. It didn't happen that way, at least during that period. And this guy from Chicago was sent to go and organize, carry out a couple of terrorism uprising events, turn around, back to Chicago again, back to Chicago again. So NATO, the Gladio operation via Turkish military and Turkish godfather, ultra-nationalist, criminal thug, paramilitary, continued until around 1996. Towards the, you know, period like 1994 to 1996, the decision makers, the top layers of NATO, the U.S., you know, what we usually refer to as shadow government, their powers, they were having this debate. They were having this two options in front of them, two plans. Which one is better? One is what they did before the fall of the Soviet Union, and that was using ultranationalism, fascism, okay, against the Soviet Union, against communism, versus what they have already seen as a very successful plan. One, they saw it in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen's Bin Laden group. But then recently, and this is 1994, 1995, 1996, they were seeing its use again and again in the Balkans, in the Kosovo region, in Bosnia. And this is when we have all this Mujahideen, Bin Laden, Zawahiri, think about, you know, factions from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, bringing them to Turkey, train them, bring them over there. It was like, you know, these ultra-nationalists, they haven't been very productive, and we think the Mujahideen Islamist factions are going to be much more useful in our main objective of taking over, having more of this ex-Soviet blocs on our side, okay, on our side. So this is during this, sometimes we use them, sometimes we use the, you know, the fascist, godfather, ultra-nationalist. But then in end of 1996, Abdullah Çatlı, the man we've been talking about, the thug who went to Xinjiang, and also he comes to Turkey for another mission that he was going to go and implement. However, while he's in Turkey, together with some beauty queen and a few other colleagues, they are in Turkey. They're traveling in this black Mercedes, and they have a car crash, and they die. Everyone in the car except one guy dies, right? Well, before the Turkish police or military got to the bodies, the local police that wouldn't know anything about who are these people, and the local journalists got to the scene. And lo and behold, here is the world's most wanted man, Abdullah Çatlı, the great godfather, with all his diplomatic passports with him. But not only that, together with him, you have the chief of police of Turkey. I mean, the top police guy. You have incredibly important, legit political figures. It was like WTF moment. What are they doing in the car with this guy? Basically, this was when in Turkey, even though it had been leaked in little bits and pieces, it was this huge exposure of the thugs, criminal, you know, ultra-nationalist, fascists actually working with and for the Turkish government. And for right now, I'm going to keep it Turkish government. That is the Turkish military, the legit Turkish institutions, right? So all the drug runnings they were doing, they were all controlled and managed by the state. And all the killings, the terrorisms that they were found responsible for, again, they were executed for the state. Okay? This was huge in Turkey. It caused an uproar. A lot of documents started leaking. Just like 9/11 commission, there was this huge commission established in Turkey. Nobody talked about anything else but the Susurluk. They called it Susurluk scandal because the car accident took place in Susurluk. Now, there was this fear by the West, and this is the United States, you know, the Europeans like, uh-oh. Now, we know that a lot of these commission members, they are like ours, Thomas Kuhn, but some of them, or by default, a lot of other, excuse my language, may come out about our roles, the stuff we did, we being the ultimate bosses. And guess what happened? One of the Turkish Gladio handlers in Turkey was an ambassador, United States ambassador in Turkey at the time. Okay, this guy was the ambassador from 1992 until the Susurluk scandal. No other guy than Mark Grossman, the guy I have been saying for the past, why you got to look at Mark Grossman. So with this fear that a lot of secrets, state secrets, were going to get out during these investigations and journalists digging in, some people were leaking, some people were talking, the United States right away got their man out of Turkey, Mark Grossman. No reason cited. He still had another 1.5, 2 years left. No reason cited. Guess who else was pulled? Another guy who was handling the Operation Gladio, the Turkish militant in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. This man, his name at the time, a major, Major Douglas Dickerson. This is the man, if you have read my book, if you know my case, was the one who was married to this spy in the FBI. Major Douglas Dickerson, he still had 1.5 years left. He was working for Mark Grossman in Ankara. His main task under NATO was Operation Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. There were 3 or 4 countries that he directed the Turkish paramilitary Gladio operations in those countries. Lo and behold, the same man, this is documented. He is pulled off of his position and immediately sent to a base in Germany. This is American military base, and from there to Brussels. Ha! Huh, this is interesting. Now, these characters that have been talked about in my case for 12 years were there in 1997. Susurluk happens, they were pulled out. So was the top military man, and this was the top man for the Turkish so-called counterterrorism operations commando, was sent on a mission to Washington, D.C., Turkish embassy. And again, this is documented. Right after Susurluk, they had to get him out. He was a chief guy in the military overseeing these thugs and these operations, these false terror, false flag operations, not only in Turkey, Central Asia, Caucasus, you know, a lot of Chechen operations, Eastern Europe. So he was pulled. He was sent to Washington, D.C. He never went back. Again, nobody cited any reason. They took all these important figures. They took them to Brussels, and they took them to Washington, D.C. And then it was the decision-making time for the top guys in the world, okay, for NATO, U.S., U.K., saying too much exposure. This chapter is closed. Gladio is not closed. We are going to Plan B. Gladio Plan B operations, which we have already prepared for it to some extent. And that is, we are not going to use paramilitary. We're going to use Islamist factions, who, a.k.a. Mujahideens, a.k.a. Al-Qaeda. So this
okay,
is, again, think about Bosnia.
Okay, that's an incredible amount of information. So just to be absolutely clear, I think it is clear that you're saying that the Susurluk scandal and what happened to Chatley was not something they wanted to happen. That was not something that was planned. He was not taken out of the picture, but it was a result of his death that they switched to Plan B. They weren't going to switch to Plan B until that happened.
Nobody knows the answer to that. because there are so many questions surrounding this accident. First of all, how this guy on a scratch walked out of the car, okay? And there were also some questions about that they may have been actually dead before the accident, because there were this autopsy report that their heads, both the, you know, a few of them were broken before the crash. So nobody knows who's responsible. Was that staged? If so, which faction? Is it something that, okay, the top guy said, we want to eventually eliminate these guys because they're in some ways out of control. We want to go to plan B? Was it someone else? We don't know. And to this date, you know how we scream about 9/11? Well, in Turkey, since 1996, people have been screaming Susurluk. Instead of 9/11, they say Susurluk, because a lot of stuff, whether it's the deep state, a lot of questions that still remain unanswered about, and that's one of them. And that is, was it an accident? We don't know. Nobody knows.
And were any of the other Babas similarly rubbed out in interesting incidents?
One interesting character who was, again, a huge figure. And we used to have a little summer cottage, my husband and I, because we went to Turkey every year before all this FBI things happened, whistleblowing. And then this little small fishing village city, which is now very fashionable. It wasn't back then when we got it. But one of the Babas had a few hotels and casinos there while actually we were there. I was in Turkey, and this is like 1998. He was assassinated during the daylight. A lot of these Gladio Babas were being taken out. And in some cases, they would get some other Babas, take out some other Babas. So Godfather against Godfather, who was, you know, managing one Godfather against, but a lot of them were taken out. And again, now this is when we completely went to plan B, we, United States, NATO, and said, we're going to use Mujahideen. What happened to the ultra-nationalist fascist guys? For a while, you know, some of the main ones were taken out. Some of the other ones were left alone. They stayed rogue for a while, tried to have their own thing. It's like United States kind of is turning its back to us. We were back. And the same thing is true with the state. So things for a while were kind of murky. Then came the current Turkish regime, the Islamic government in Turkey. It's very interesting because in the United States, a lot of things came out, writing saying U.S. was kind of worried about this Islamic government in Turkey. Is what is going to happen in Turkey? Are they going to end up being another Iran, et cetera, et cetera? It's so interesting. It's like using reverse psychology with people. And you get to see that a lot in Middle East. And that is, let's say U.S. wants to install a puppet regime there. One of the first things that has to happen, there needs to be this illusion that U.S. is worried about this regime and that this regime is tough on U.S. or Israel to get the support of the majority to be legitimized. So in many cases, that's actually a tactic, okay? It's like you right there, you say you're concerned when this is your first choice. This is what you want for Turkey. This is being U.S. wanting this government in Turkey. Since they went to plan B, that was always the plan. It's like, we want this so-called moderate Islamic government there. Now, after Çatlı's death, when we completely, the Gladio went to plan B mode for Central Asia Caucasus via Islam and these Islamic factions, they already had a candidate in mind, a leader. And this man was this preacher, this symbol of fanatic Islam in Turkey. Now they no longer call them fanatic because he's supported by U.S. We call him a moderate Islamist. And his name is Fethullah Gülen. Now, Fethullah Gülen was preaching in Turkey during these 1990s against the secular government. You know, in Turkey, we need to have a government that reflects more people's value, which is Islam. You know, we have to go back to our roots. It was a different form of ultranationalists. You know, ultranationalists were like, we don't want to be part of EU. We want Turkish culture. In fact, all these Central Asian countries, they are, we want to get together with them, take over them, and make this great Turkic republic. Now, this preacher, Fethullah Gülen, said the same thing, but he didn't